the more you damage the virtual patient, the better your learning curve is going to be.
Hi, I'm Alex, and welcome to the XHealth Show, where I talk to visionaries behind the latest innovations in healthcare for the extra health of the future. We're in startup space in Schlieren, near Zurich, Switzerland, where a dog bed reminds of a fluffy guardian of robotic arms overlooking glass atrium. I met my guest thanks to Hemmecks. Gayatri Venkat, the CEO of Simulatory, comes from a family of doctors but instead pursued a successful career as a software engineer and quality assurance expert. Now her skills revolutionize surgeons' training. Simulatory is a Swiss startup that developed VR Spine, a smart spinal endoscopy simulator that feels like real surgery thanks to advanced haptics. Whether you're a junior or senior surgeon, AI Mentor will challenge you accordingly. You'll hear about ultra-minimally invasive endoscopic surgery, herniated disc, spinal stenosis, startup medical doctors collaboration, and how I caused a major bleeding a couple of minutes into surgery. Gayatri, how much time or attempts does it take to go through the surgery without hurting the virtual patient?
You mean in the simulation that we developed?
Right.
Initially they have to get adjusted to the dexterities. And usually people are about five or six times the patient gets killed, the virtual patient, I mean.
Right.
The reason predominantly is the learning curve. They are still getting to know the anatomy in and around even the virtual reality simulations. So if you can compare it to what happens in OR, that's just bad, you know. But the good thing about virtual reality is that you can reset and start from where you left off.
Yeah, I've just asked that, guys, because I actually tried it. So I tried VR Spine and I caused a major bleeding in a couple of minutes. And I actually couldn't stop it in six more minutes when we just exited the simulation. And it was interlaminar discectomy. And apparently the patient was the bleeder. So, I mean, I'm not a doctor, right? And Gayatri, you're also not a doctor.
No,
so it is also a disclaimer, guys. We are not doctors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Here. Yeah. So how long is the training with the use of your simulation?
Yeah, that's a great question, Alex, because the training that we provide, it's not one-size-fits-all solution. So what I mean by that is it adjusts according to what is your competency. So let's say a chief of surgeon comes in and wants to take a crack at it. For him, it would probably be anywhere between 45 minutes to an hour, depending on what case is matched to his skill level. But for a resident, even the simplest cases takes that much time. This is the problem, right? Because it takes that much level of competency and technical advantage or advancement in yourself to gain that proficiency that you are able to wrap this case as soon as possible. And that's where we are trying to bridge the gap in the learning process itself. Right now, studies say that a surgeon, even anybody who wants to learn this, the experienced surgeons also, who are currently operating on spine, minimally invasive spine, 44 attempts.
44 attempts to learn this ultra minimal invasive endoscopic procedure.
Exactly. This is a published study in various forums, and that is how much the learning curve is.
But this is, they counted real cases. I mean, the real people.
Real people.
Mm-hmm.
So it is as simple as this. You need to do 44 surgeries to be able to be proficient in the steps that need to be done. So there are steps. First, you remove the muscle, like you saw. Then comes the flavum, which is thin, depending on the patient. Then comes the fat. And then you see the spinal cord or the systems. So to reach and to understand those steps and to know what to do next and what not to do, it takes 44 times.
Yeah, I can imagine totally. Because, I mean, so I got to this first step of muscles and this is what I actually ended.
Correct.
Yeah. What actually can go wrong in this virtual world, so in this simulation?
That's the beauty of simulation, right? You can make mistakes, so there is no right or wrong. What we offer as a company is a safe place for you to play around, and we import real operating room feel into it. You can see the force that you apply. You get to know where you went wrong, and you get to try it again, which is not possible or should not be done in a real surgery.
Right.
So it's a safe environment to train and play around, to make mistakes, because we all learn from mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. So, and learn from those and to improve. So there is not much that I would say can go wrong. The more errors you commit, the better for you, because then you're not going to be able to repeat those in the real environment.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it can be, I'm still, asking stubbornly about what can go wrong, but because it might be what, like the bleeding, because you mentioned that, you know, virtual patients don't survive some of these.
Correct.
So what, yeah.
So what one of the complex issues or one of the major errors that we track is you go and nip the spinal cord, which could paralyze the patient in real OR if, God forbid, no one does that. But if that happens, you can completely paralyze the patient, hip down, or death, because your spine is directly connected to your brain. So that is one of the biggest problems. And in the virtual world, you can actually commit that because you have to know your way around how not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one major error that we track. And if they are too close to the spinal cord, you will see some indications coming in saying, move back, move back. And even despite that, if they are too into it, sometimes these surgeons who learn, they get too excited. Hey, I gonna go a little further. I want to do this. I want to do that. So they, unknowingly, they just do it.
Right.
But that's the beauty of it. You play, you understand what not to do, and you kill the virtual patient, which is okay.
Uh-huh.
Because we don't count on the... We do track the errors. This is a major error. So once this happens, this is what is called in the neurosurgery world as the Japanese flag. You know the Japanese flag? It's white,
right,
on the outside, and there
the
is
red
a red
dot.
And you saw how small the incisions are. Yeah. I showed you the tools.
Yeah. Well, so it's like what?
7 millimeters or less. Okay.
And
Around 5 to 7 is the usual size, but different manufacturers have different, you know, comfort levels and tools and the sizes. So it's usually between 5 and 7 millimeters.
So that's the incision.
Correct.
And that's the cannula dimension.
Correct. Yeah. And I showed you, it's ear big. It's like half or even 1/4 of your pointer.
Right.
And if you see all red, like what we saw when the bleeding happened for the bleeder, that's called a Japanese flag. That means that you have hit something.
Uh-huh.
There is some major issue. And that's where you need to retrace your steps back on the virtual patient and see how you can improve. Either you cauterize, you come out, you take a different approach, you see it from different angle, you adjust your optics. So these are things that they have to learn. No one can teach every step of it, because a person who learns from his mistakes knows how not to commit it.
Mm-hmm.
And to answer your question, you know, coming back, circling back to that, the more you damage the virtual patient, the better your learning curve is going to be.
How do they train now?
That's an excellent question.
It's the opposite, right? I mean, they can't hurt anyone.
Correct. So right now the trainings happen in two phases. One is they have these cardboard boxes. I can show you. It's a cardboard box, and they have these small holes cut into the cardboard box. And through that, they send these tools and ask the surgeons to get the dexterity. I mean, come on. That's like building a mouse trap for your kid. It looks like arts and crafts. And this is not in some third world country, okay? This is in Switzerland.
Okay. And can they feel
nothing?
Okay. Because
nothing.
With your simulations of this VR spine, you actually can feel it.
Exactly. And that's the advantage. And the second part is these 3D printed anatomies, where you print a particular case and then you keep training on it. But that's not going to be the case that you will face in the OR. And it's a printer cartridge model, so it's very expensive. And there is a lot of waste, plastic waste. And you have to book out your OR. So to do a training on those printed cartridges, you need to book your whole OR out. There is bleeding, there is everything. So that's time lost on the hospital, time lost on the OR time where they can actually make money. So this is where the virtual training kicks in, because you don't need a specific setup. You saw how small the system was. It's just that's it. You can sit in one corner of the surgeon's table and he can just import a case and start training.
Yeah. So let's actually describe it now, the VR spine. So we have like two joysticks, or can I call them joysticks?
Yeah.
And then
you can.
We have a screen.
Yeah.
We have a laptop or some, you know, bigger system, and that's it, right?
Exactly.
We'll be right back. This episode is brought to you by The Exhale Show and me, Alex. If you still haven't,
please hit follow at the top. That'll help me bring more of these visionaries to you. Thanks a lot. Stay awesome now. Back to the episode.
So the VR spine system itself is very compact. It sits about, I would say, half a desk space, a small desk space. And it usually comes with a laptop or a desktop system of your choice. So we give these desktop systems for bigger training centers so that where there is not a lot of movement. So some of our doctors like to carry it in the briefcases and they like to take it around. Mm-hmm. So it's maximum, it's 5 kilos. That's it. And it comes with two haptic devices, which are those robots that you saw, a protective casing and optional extra screen and a keyboard. That's it. And then pedals to cauterize. That's it. So it's very, very small and very, very portable.
So what you just said is actually when there is a surgeon that does training, I mean, he or she can take the suitcase with him or her
yep.
and then do the training. Or if there is like a training center, they have basically a bigger training station.
Yeah, correct. So the training centers usually get deployed at a training station. Sometimes they request a laptop because it gives them mobility. But usually it's the training the training systems are the desktop systems because they are stationary.
And what procedures actually can now residents train with simulatory?
Yeah, so immediately we can offer all the uniportal. So there are two approaches to endoscopic surgery. One is uniportal, which is you just make one small incision and then all the tools go through that one incision. The other one is called biportal. It's the same endoscopy, but you make two incisions and one goes your camera and the other the tools, just like laparoscopy. The beauty of the biportal is that it can cover more area of the spine because your spine is divided into 5 sections, right? You have your sagittal, you have your lumbar, thoracic, cervical, and then you have the brain. So that's the whole spectrum for you. So with the biportal, you can pretty much go from the sagittal all the way or your tailbone all the way up to the cervical bone, which is the neck. It's beautiful. And the incisions are still 7 millimeters maximum.
With one incision?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So with one incision, you can cover the lumbar, all
right.
the lumbar.
Yeah.
And but then with when you two, you can go all the way up to
That's
your...
That's amazing.
And right now we offer all the modules for uniportal, which is single port. We are under development is our biportal with our excellent KOLs. So right now the residents can easily train on interlaminar discectomy, transforaminal, and stenosis. Stenosis is what you saw, the drilling of the deformed bone.
So actually I was drilling into the bone, and which was kind of a disaster, you know, because now just imagine you have this cannula, which is like 5 to 7 millimeters, and you need to find the right place to drill. I mean, you know, the neurosurgeons, I mean, they are amazing. You know, they see where to go, you know, in that space. That's absolutely, absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we said about the procedures, but what actually from the patient's perspective, like what diseases or what spine conditions does it cover?
So it covers the lumbar disc herniations. So what is a disc herniation for people who don't know it? We all know that the spine is made up of distinct discs and there is this nice little cushion between these two discs. What happens is sometimes those cushions either press on each other or there is a bulge, especially in older patients who have like, for whatever reasons, hereditary, slouched position, occupation, the disc actually bulges out. The material splits out and instead of protecting what is next or what is underneath or upwards of it, it starts pressing on it. So it's, you can actually imagine this as I like to tell people as a box of crayons that you have. There should be 12 sets, right? 12 individual crayons. Let's say you purposely add few more. So what happens? You disturb the space. One goes on top of the other. You cannot close the box and then it bursts out. That's exactly what happens. And because of this, there is pain. The first symptom is pain, shooting pain in the legs. And the interesting thing is the cervical discs, what we used to call as spondylitis, that is also a symptom. You start having pain in your arms. This is more predominant in rugby players, athletes, Pilates dancers, Pilates, or your people who do like these extreme activities. So that's exactly what happens. So these are the conditions that we address in our simulations today. Mm-hmm. Lumbar discectomies that can be done endoscopically.
Okay, going back to your simulation, there is some what you call AI mentor.
Correct.
Right. So how, yeah, so it's what, minute 14, we have AI on the show. What's the role of AI in your simulation?
That's actually a really good question. So when we started Simulatory, we were with this vision that we want to be different from what is available there, because we came out of Symbionics. We worked with Symbionics, so we know exactly what they were doing. It was repetitive. So where the AI mentor comes in is, like the name suggests, it's a mentor. So if you enable it, it records the whole session for you. So it does three key things. It records the whole session. It monitors what you do, but it doesn't disturb you in between when you're actually doing the training. So it just monitors and it takes notes, just like a mentor.
Right.
And in the end of the training, you have a performance metrics or a performance sheet. It attaches videos where it feels you made a mistake and where you can improve. And you get an email or whatever you have subscribed. You get your performance sent out, and you can actually see the errors that you made in small snippets from the mentor itself, saying that this is where you did wrong. This is not how it should be done. And it also gives you perspective as to how you can improve. And and if you have a training scheduled in like 2 weeks or 3 weeks or in the future, it resends the same email again before a couple of days before your training. This way you don't forget. And when you come back to the training session on that day, you know what not to do. So this is one. The second one is, as you begin your training, it knows, it tracks, and it is able to adjust your difficulty. Let's say the bleeding step, 10 minutes, we cannot do anything. Mm-hmm. What it does is it changes the scene for you in the background, makes it look like you did something right. And then what happens is it reduces the difficulty at that step by helping you. And this way you can pass that step and go to the next one. So let's say in the next step, you just got it in the first attempt. So the next time you train, it's gonna make that step three difficult for you to pass. So this way it gives you a variety and challenges you and doesn't bore you. Because one of the feedbacks that we got from our initial iterations with the doctors is that, you know what, three or four times on the software, I know how to get around it. That's not what you want. Mm-hmm. I mean, that defeats the purpose of having a training system, right? So this is the second thing. The third thing is it matches you. So you, as you build your history on the VR spine system, it matches you with an appropriate case pulled from the database for you to train on. So let's say after 10 attempts, you know that you are excellent in interlaminar. So for the 11th attempt, you're going to get a bleeder. You're going to get someone who is diabetic. All these conditions that happen in real time in OR.
Hmm.
So this is the job of the mentor.
Okay, I totally can imagine like what patients gain when they don't have an inexperienced, you know, surgeon, you know, operating on them.
Mm-hmm.
And what do senior doctors say about that?
Oh, the one of our biggest customers have been the senior doctors, because they are the people who have the most small time to train. So even them, you have to keep up or upskill yourself, and they have to maintain their certifications, and they have to have some of these credits done for them to keep up the specialties. It's even true for chief of surgeons. They have to attend certain courses, certain things, but they are the people who are bogged down with a lot of administrative tasks. And these guys are one of our target audience, because for them, we have a separate training called as freeform mode or a problem-based learning mode. So for them, we actually provide another mode called problem-based learning. So let's say the chief of surgery has 10 minutes on his hand and he just wants to, you know, keep his dexterity warm. So he goes there, he locks into this mode, and then the system asks him, what step do you want to train? So these guys are experienced surgeons. They are not going to have hiccups in knowing this is the next step I have to do. So let's say they say, give me a case where the patient has two herniations, or there is a fused disc, there is scoliosis, or there is decompression in two or three places. So in the 10 minutes, they can actually use it effectively, because then the system picks up only those steps and challenges them again with the AI proctor, and it goes in. They can go in, utilize the 10 minutes and train on what they want and not be forced to go through the entire pathway, which is a waste of time. Because they exactly know where they have the problem, right? Because they have done at least 100 or 200 surgeries in the lifetime until now. So their need is very different from that of the residents and the Fahads or the Oberarts. So this is where the extra learning modes called problem-based learning helps, because we identify where they have the issues and we can tackle it at that specific point. So the chief of surgery at some of the hospitals, they really like this approach because it is most efficient and it is much, much easier for them to utilize the time. It is time that is valuable, right? So, yeah.
I saw some videos on your website when actually surgeons say that, well, it feels real. So could you tell now a bit more about, you know, the 3D haptics that mm-hmm. you use? Like, how did you actually learn or taught, you know, the system? Machine, yeah, how it should feel like, right? Because, I mean, so I cut through the muscle on VR spine. I have no idea how does it feel to cut through the muscle. But, I mean, these surgeons, I mean, they exactly know what they're talking about. So how did you learn to what should be, what should it feel like?
That's the beauty of haptics, right? It's revolutionary and it's life-changing if you use it properly. And most people have what is called as passive haptics, where they put in dummies or, I don't know, rubber material inside and say it's tactile. So what we have on our cell phones is haptic still,
right?
But it is tactile. So what you feel here is kinesthesia. What that means is, I like to say haptics as reverse robotics. So if you have a robot, like we all played with these robot toys, right? You have these joysticks, you press forward, it goes forward. That's a robot.
Right.
So haptics is reverse of that. Haptics works where, so let's take the same robot example. So now I say forward, the robot is in forward position. So the robot needs to know that it has to go forward to achieve from point A to point B. But in haptics, it is the reverse. I already am at point B. It knows that it has to be in point B. Now, it has to push me back to tell me what kind of feel I get. So it is basically the reverse. So you are backtracking with the robot. So this is where people really, and haptics is very subjective. So what feels like soft to me, to you, it might feel as firm, just like our skin. So how do we compromise? So this is where one of our patents come in. So we have developed our custom in-house libraries for these material properties. What I showed you, you remember?
Right.
The different material properties.
Mm-hmm.
Those were developed by us. We did a lot of research. Our CTO, Venkat, he was the pioneer in haptics. He came out of Sensible Technologies, which was the world's first haptic company out of MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. And he worked for that for almost 14 years. So we had the patents. Now 3D Systems owns it. And we take the systems out of 3D Systems. So our CTO, who we are extremely blessed to have, he developed this in-house from scratch. And it took us 4 years to get those libraries properly working and aligned and applied to these different materials that you see in the virtual scene. A blood should feel like this. And we had to go through a lot of feedback loop with our surgeons. And it's just not one or two people.
This is what I wanted to ask. Like, how did you collaborate? Because I can imagine actually you also didn't have that, you know, knowledge about like how it should feel like.
Correct. So the good thing about haptics is you can, just like AI models, you can have haptic models and you can train them. And we had these videos, anonymized videos, like the one you saw with Dr. Derman, Peter B. Derman. So we had some of those videos and you can tell the system how, or ask how, what are the parameters that it thinks can be extracted out of it. And that was step one for us. So that gave us a bit of a baseline. And we had to improve on it by feedback from our KOL. So if you see in our website, we have some fantastic KOLs. Dr. Founier, Dr. Simonin, Dr. Gerhard, who was our first supporter indeed, and Dr. Leibel, Dr. I don't want to miss anybody, Dr. Welchley, and we have Dr. Ralph now. So it has been amazing. So we went through this feedback loop predominantly with Dr. Founier from Hospital of Sion in Valle. They were very, very supportive. They helped us throughout this journey. Like for the past 2 years, they have been giving us feedback. And they also bought one of our first systems. So there are surgeons in Switzerland who are pioneering these techniques, who are not known that well because they choose to be like that. They are very humble. And when given an opportunity to talk to you and people like you, I just put their name out because people should know these surgeons are really doing a difference. They are making a difference. Dr. Founier, Dr. Simonin, Dr. Gerhard, who is retired now, Dr. Welchli, and Dr. Leubel. And we also have Dr. Steenen from Kantonsspital St. Gallen. So these guys are pioneering in the field of endoscopic spine in Switzerland. And it is really blessing that we got to work with each of them. And it gave us the opportunity to iterate and understand. And as this became more and more matured, we started this project in 2019, but we floated the company only in 2021 once we had a MVP, the viable product, the minimum viable product. So, yeah.
We'll be right back. I want to say thank you for listening to this episode. If you find it interesting and feel particularly generous today, leave a review, hit this star rating. I'll be able to continue with the X-Health show for you. 3, 2, 1, and back to the episode. So it took you a couple of years to create this library?
Correct. Okay. So it took us about 2.5 years to create the libraries and come up with our first minimum viable product, both on the haptics and also on the interlaminar was our first module, on the first module itself.
Why didn't you become a doctor yourself?
That's a question I get asked multiple times because, I mean, it's a valid question. I was destined to be a doctor, let me actually put it that way. I mean, it's in the Indian culture that if you have a family of doctors, you just take the path and it's that's how it is.
Right. So your father and mother, they both are doctors.
Yeah, yeah. So my dad used to be in the medtech field for a very long time. My mom used to teach and my brother is a cardiologist.
Okay.
So my dad is very well exposed to the nuances of how to sell and the procurement side and whatnot. My mom is a teacher and my brother took up cardiology and he is very successful in India. So when it came to me, I like medicine and I like what he does. I have seen him come home half the day. I don't see him because he has some emergency cases and he just bunks. So the dedication and the fact that you can save a life, that's something that no other profession can give you that satisfaction, you know, and the heartache. So when it was time for me to decide which direction I'm going to take, I always loved medicine. I love dogs. I wanted to be a veterinarian, actually. Which is out there, I know. It was either a veterinarian or it was a neurosurgeon. But
oh, wow, okay.
Crazy, right? Crazy life. But I became neither. The reason for that was when I had a discussion with my brother, he was very encouraging and he said, yeah, it's a good thing, but veterinary field is this. You need to have a heart of stone because there is more depth there for obvious reasons. Mm. And I was not that great. Mm-hmm. I cannot see an animal suffer. I don't. Then and there, I decided that's not the field for me. Then the second one option was neurosurgery, which fascinated me because there was very less people doing that in India and very less all over the world. After I moved to US and started working for 3D Systems, I learned it. Then I was like, huh. But by the time it was too late. So tracing back or coming back. So I started exploring these options and you have to pick your specialty. In India, it's like you either go into medicine or you go into engineering. So these are the two forks that divide when you are in your high school. So I had a discussion again with my brother and he said, you know what? I have this training course which has basics of these anatomies in the brain that we teach in the college. Why don't you come and you can just see what happens? So I went with him.
And you fainted.
I hated it.
You hated it. Oh, wow.
The reason for that was the smell of the cadavers, man. It was death. So pungent and I couldn't. And we have to wear these thick, these big lead vests. I developed a back pain and it didn't go away for 7 days or more than that. And so painful. So leave aside that we can work with it. You can probably build a muscle for it and do something. But the cadavers, you know, they put me off. And it was gross. See, I mean, if a real patient bleeds, you know the blood is going to be red. You know certain things. You know how to patch him up. Trust me, you don't want to cut open a cadaver.
Mm.
And that threw me off. And I was like, nope, no way.
Mm.
And then when I went home, I had this retrospective and I was thinking to myself and said, you know what? No, if I go that route where I'm not fully into committing myself to that kind of a lifestyle and going through these things, I don't think I'll be a good doctor. So I did the next best thing. I became an engineer. And my master thesis involved, in fact, why people are refraining from taking up medicine. Because in my own high school, 80% of the girls or the women, we went into engineering. Only 20 went into medicine. And even in that 20, none of them took up doctors. Most of them ended up being nurses or midwives. So there is something that is going on in that community, which none of us are able to see. So I did my thesis on that. And it was startling to know that women were put off by the amount of bad training equipments that were there for medicine training. They were not hygienic.
Mm-hmm.
They were not pleasant. I mean, we don't expect rose petals, okay? But it's gross.
Mm-hmm.
Ask a female surgeon. I spoke to one today morning, Dr. Marissa. She's a pioneer in IANS. She's the board. She's the first female board member in IANS. Big shout out to her. So these are women who were able to overcome these hurdles. Heart of steel. And I didn't have it. And I didn't have the stomach for it. And apparently most girls didn't. So out of 10, 8 of them went to engineering, only 2, and that gets cut down. How many do you think will end up in neurosurgery? 0.1. That was the result, and it was startling. And when I went to 3D systems and when I got exposed to this technology of digital training, it changed my mindset. And like, God, why didn't people not have this when I wanted to do medicine? And I went back to those same cohort. I told them if you had I sent a study again to them saying that, if you had a digital option to train on, would you pursue? You wouldn't believe 60% of them said yes.
Hmm.
The 20 were outliers. They said, we lost interest. We are happy with the money we make. I don't have the thing. But 60%, these are women in their late 20s
mm-hmm.
at that time.
Right. So actually your VR spine can also, well, encourage, or like maybe there will be less dropouts at this point.
That's the point. So that's the study that I want to do
mm-hmm.
with some of these residents saying, you don't want them going away, right? I mean, training or the way a pathway to education should not gross people out.
Mm.
If it starts grossing people out, you're not going to be able to study. You're going to be a bad study. If you push in that direction, right? How many have we heard stories saying that I didn't like that, but I still had to do because I was forced to do it.
Right.
So yeah, so that's one of the reasons why I didn't become a doctor. I took the second best thing. If there is a change that I can bring about through this company, Simulatory, and our VR spine on and our up and coming surgical training systems and get more women involved, because women are better doctors. I'm sorry, all our KOLs out there, but we are more patient. So
they are more caregivers, right?
Correct. Mother, you know, they are more mothering. That's in our nature. And more women have to be doctors if we had to better our society to achieve a better quality of life. That doesn't mean that men are not, okay? But it is in our inherent nature. Our gut instincts are more stronger. So why not encourage them to go there, which can better the society along with the men, which is going to only make things better for us. So, yeah, but it's a totally different problem, but it's true. And the studies don't lie. So this is one of the areas that I personally have my own personal agenda for becoming part of Simulatory and taking the CEO position and standing there and telling people that don't get grossed out, there are options.
I also noticed that in your team, there is a gaming expert. Yeah, what does gaming have to do basically with VR spine and, you know, the spine surgeries?
Let's put it this way. The gaming expert's main job is to gamifying the simulation, making it more fun. He brings in a lot of experience working with bigger companies, AAA titled companies. So we use Unity, which is the game engine that you had to put out as an exe or an executable file. So for us to combine the libraries of, so he works closely with Venkat, and Venkat works on the haptics, and there are other things that are needed like GUI, UI, UX, user interface, user experience, and then combining them and making these executables. So the gamification aspects comes into play on how you present it and how interesting it looks. So if I just show you when you open the screen, or when you see this pop-up screens on, and you just open it up and you see all blood everywhere, are you gonna be motivated to try it? No. So how do you gamify it? That's exactly where the gaming expert comes in, and he's very critical for the team, and he's been excellent. Louis, thank you so much. And so his main job is to keep the users hooked, just like how it happens in other games like PS4 or something. It's still game, right? But you don't, I mean, people can ask the same question. Okay, why do I need a Unity or some sort of an engine to run the game? You can just put some steps out and I can do it with my mouse, right? But that's not the point. How do you keep your users engaged? Right. And that is where the gaming engines have come a very long way. And how do you make haptics work with those games? So this is where both of them come in, and they work hand in hand to make this happen for us.
Can you go like a few steps back and like, actually, how did you come up with the idea of, you know, a software and this whole station, training station for spine surgeons?
Oh, that's the beginning story, right? It's an interesting one, because honestly, we didn't start with spine. What we had was what is today patented as the smart simulation platform, which had the combination of kinesthetic haptics, artificial intelligence, and smart sensors.
So you knew what elements you want in the station.
That came from our experience working in 3D systems and getting to knowing Symbionics, what they didn't have and what we can have. Because that's, you have to be smart about it, right? You don't want to be another Symbionics. They were a great company. They still are a great company. But you need to differentiate yourself and also keep up with the trends that are coming up, the technology trends, and also the deep tech. So that was what we had. The component was what we had. The first we started with, our first surgery was brain. We wanted to do open craniotomy. But when we presented the concept, and that was our MVP, actually, our minimum viable product was for brain surgery. It was for open craniotomy. It was called Neurobotic.
Mm-hmm. Why are you laughing?
No, because whenever I say that name, Neurobotic, it sounds like a Roomba.
Well, you know? Fair enough.
Yeah. So think about it. You say Neurobotic, all you remember is that round Roomba going around in your room. But that was the logic behind it. We want people to relate, and, you know, because that's what brands do.
Yeah.
And that was our MVP. So we presented it to our then KOLs, Dr. Johnny Fournier, Simonin, and Dr. Steenan. And they were like, you know what? These components, they would be great for spine. Just go a bit down. Do spine. Because if you do spine, we will buy it from you.
Well, they didn't want the brain, or they were fine with what they do
so
on the brain.
The brain, there are still very low people or very lesser number of surgeons taking up neurosurgery, apparently for the reasons of risks.
Right.
And the neurosurgeons cannot operate on brain after a certain age. But that's not the case with the spine. So their point was, if you do the spine first with these components, we can actually have a broader audience. First point. The second one is, this is interesting because we come from the US, and in the US, it's completely a different game. I'll tell you what is different, because I had to rephrase it. So in the US, if you are in the neurosurgery department, you only do brain surgeries, at least in 90% of the hospitals that we have exposed to. If you're spine, you only work on spine. If you're orthopedic, you only work on the knee, hip, hand, blah, blah. But here in Europe, the neurosurgeons work on spine. The spine surgeons work on spine. The orthopedics work on spine.
Okay.
But the interesting thing is, the orthopedics and the spine surgeons cannot work on the brain. Mm. Only the neurosurgeons can. So now you see why we forged into spine, because it expanded our audience. And as a growing company, it was very important for us to have a broader audience or a broader sales funnel, let's say, to address the market and grow. Because neurosurgery is a subsect of spine. So why don't we target spine? And when these doctors gave us the confidence that this product is going to revolutionize the market, build this, get it to a certain stage, we will buy it to you. We'll buy it from you.
How did you learn their trust? Because it's an awesome feedback a startup can get.
Exactly.
And then also, so there's a couple of questions really, you know. So the trust, and the second thing is like, did you have like a second thought? I was like, nah, you know. Like, why would we? We have a great, you know, already.
Correct. See, that comes with experience, right? So I'll answer your second question first. The reason for that, it ties to the first question. So you said, why would I listen to you? I will go with Neurobotic because I have built it.
Right.
I mean,
I spent so much time on it. You know, it's ready.
Why would I go?
Yeah.
You have to listen to your market because these guys are just not KOLs.
Right.
They are going to be our customers. And if they say that, this thing is great, but there is potential if you apply it to another field. And you shouldn't be stupid enough not to listen to that. Most startups, when they pivot, at least what we have seen, it comes with experience because we are not out of college, right? We exited our own companies, we refunded, and this is our second company. So first, you always listen to what the market tells you. If you have a component that can be expanded into other areas of surgery, you go there. And let's say, hypothetically, we don't listen to the doctors. Instead of having 20 customers or 300 customers, I would end up having 100 customers. So why should I shoot myself on the foot?
Mm-hmm.
There is a reason these guys are called key opinion leaders. They know not just the technical or the medical know-how, the steps. They are skilled and they know the market trends because some of these big companies are always interacting with them. So we listened and we pivoted. So that's your second question, tying it back to the first one. And how did we earn the trust? It's because, again, we listened to them. Despite us coming from a medical simulation perspective and doing or not doing what you just said, who are you to tell me I know this field better? We basically listened to them, went back to them with the spine product. So that made them believe that we value their opinion. And when someone that you are interacting with knows that you value their feedback, trust comes automatically. And we did have a lot of interactions with them. We were very open. And we built trust over a period of time, definitely. And mostly because we took their advice to heart and we implemented it. And we are successful because of it. And we don't shy away from telling in public that these doctors were one of the main reasons for our success. And that gave them, or that built the trust or solidified the trust even more further.
What was your first startup? You just mentioned that, you know, you exited one. Like, what were the learnings
you had? So we were part of Symbionix.
Mm.
So when Symbionix got sold out, we cashed out our shares.
Okay. And this is also how you were able to bootstrap.
Yes,
with
exactly.
Simulatory.
Yes. So Simulatory, as you know, was a COVID baby.
Mm.
And we absolutely were terrified when that hit, to be very honest. And I don't want to sound like arrogant and say, yeah, I know this is going to succeed. And no, we were terrified because the funding was running low. Even now it is low. The market is not that great. But we had the luxury we were fortunate enough to have some cash on our hand from our exiting out and cashing out and selling and using some of these to bootstrap. That's why we started it as a GmbH, because it's needed the less incorporation capital. And we used whatever money was left to actually make the minimum viable product. And we sold these products out to these doctors. We have revenue. And so pretty much that helped us to sustain the company until the right type of investors came in.
So VR Spine is already on the market, right?
Yes, the first version is already on the market.
Right. And how did you go about the pilots? Like, what do they look like? The pilots with the surgeons?
Yeah.
What feedback did you get? What I don't know, changes did you implement?
So we went through a lot of feedback. We still keep improving it. I would say the product is already commercialized, but we do take some feedbacks very seriously. The loop as in for any startup. We had a couple of revisions on the way it is set up. So if you see it now, they sit side by side like they are beside each other. One of the feedbacks that we got was initially when we started out, they were facing each other like that.
Uh-huh.
So the surgeon said, that's not how it is. The patient doesn't feel like that. So turn. And it's not very ergonomic. So we turned it. So that was one design change. The second one was on the way we interact. Some of the surgeons wanted to know how much force they are applying. That brought out the force meters.
Mm-hmm.
And then what the main feedback were on what metrics can we actually measure. Because most of our surgeons, they love publishing papers. And with the cadaver or a 3D printed anatomy or with the cardboard box, it's not possible. So what would you measure? Time was the only measure.
Mm-hmm.
So these surgeons who were the guys that I mentioned, they wanted to revolutionize how these things are quantified. How do you track a resident's performance?
Right.
So then came about, because it's a robot, it can track everything. So then we narrowed down on what are those things that can be tracked using this. Let's say the wrong tool is used. You are too deep into the muscle layer. You're going to nip the patient. You kill the virtual patient. So those kind of metrics, which you cannot track in a cadaver or on a dummy plastic anatomy or on the cardboard box.
Mm.
So these were some of the major changes that we did during the course of our improvement cycles.
Right. Just to mention for you guys who are not familiar, cadaver is a corpse, basically. So this is the assessment, like they can have a quantified assessment of a resident, basically, right?
Yeah, yeah. So they can track whatever they want. And the beauty is everything is recorded. And if they want to publish a paper, they can just strip out all the names and just publish it in like a 2 days work as opposed to 14 or even 3 weeks currently.
Mm-hmm. And from your perspective, like, was there or is there anything like the most important in testing a solution like this? Like, is there anything you need to be, or like any steps that you should take, you know, to bring a solution like that to the market? You've had career in quality assurance, right?
Yeah.
So how do you make sure basically to that the product you bring to the market has the quality you want it to have?
Absolutely. That's actually one of the focuses of what we call as a customer engagement program. Even if we don't hear back from customers that we have sold, we either go in person, it's either me or Venkat, we are the founders of the company. So we go in person, we set up an appointment, we talk to them, we understand what they like and don't like, we gather all that input, and we implement and we go back to them, and we keep this loop open. So that is one way to be sure that your product is meeting the standards or even exceeding. The second is this, we did an exercise in Sion Hospital with Dr. Founier and Dr. Simonin. They are the most driven and most focused surgeons who want to improve endoscopic spine training I have ever worked with. They both are excellent. So what they suggested when we reached out to them for an appointment is that, you know what, this is excellent. We will keep your system open. We will go into a live surgery. I'm going to do the surgery. After I am done with the surgery, I'm going to come out, try the system. And then I will know where exactly you can improve better. Now, that's commitment.
Exactly.
That's commitment.
That's totally amazing.
And they did do it. And we do have some of the improvements that they have suggested. Like some of them are graphic improvements where they see the muscle sometimes is not like botched. They want colors improved, stuff like that. But to have that much amount of involvement in something, that's commitment. And when you have people like that who surround you, automatically your product is going to stand out and it's going to exceed the expectations because it is a one-on-one comparison, what they see in real time and what they are training on. So there is no way that it's going to be of a lower standard. So this is how we keep up. And once this was successful in Sion, we started asking our other customers if they would be open to this approach. And all of them that we reached out, they really liked it.
This is amazing because I wanted, you know, to ask about first adopters, but these are not first adopters only. I mean, they go beyond that,
exactly.
Right? They are like co-creators even, right?
So they are who we call as key opinion leaders. So they take what they do seriously in every aspect of it. So these are people who can call us perfectionists. They really want to help you and they want to leave a legacy behind when they are like, you know, they are no longer able to do these surgeries. So that's the focus of some of these surgeons that we work on. And to get some of them like that on board says a lot about the technology that we have and the founders that we are and the company itself. Because you need to have a level of trust like you brought up and a level of confidence that, hey, if I tell them that this is wrong, they will improve it.
Mm-hmm.
That motivation comes only if you show them that you are equally serious and you take their words seriously. And that is exactly the type of relationship we have with our key opinion leaders. So these guys, that's why they are called KOLs. And that is the main role of a KOL, the medical know-how, the knickknacks and how to improve and how to keep on improving it.
Is the market like that? I mean, yeah.
You mean say the market like is so critical?
No,
that's the fun part. Because our KOLs themselves are so critical, I wouldn't say critical, so perfect. They are perfectionists. When we take this product out to the market, we hardly get any negative comments.
Oh.
The couple of them that we get are some of them who don't know the haptics. They struggle a bit to get acclimated. So how do I hold this pen? Mm-hmm. How do I do this? What are the physical limitations? And some of them are terrified because they are afraid that they will break the system. But it's a very resilient system. Nothing happens because you're putting it in a hospital. It has to be resilient. Those are the only few feedbacks that we keep hearing. And as for the procedures itself, the steps, we were never challenged. Every one of the others or our late adopters or our early market, we never got challenged on. Why you are doing this? This is wrong. Not one. And these are guys who are in the industry. These are doctors who do these surgeries. So, yeah.
But I can imagine there might be some, you know, doctors who are like, well, man, I've been doing it for like 40 years. Or like, why would I need this, you know, glitter of tech?
Correct. There is always those outliers. Like these are called as your late adopters or who don't conform or who don't want to conform to that path that somebody else carved. Okay, so there are always these outliers, even when this is a good example. You know Kodak?
Right.
The camera company.
Oh, yeah, I love that example.
Yeah. So these are the Kodak guys. So for people who don't know, me and Alex discussed this in our first call. These guys are the Kodak guys, you know. So Kodak, they had the best camera, the best film, everything. They were pioneers in technology, like photography. But then came your beautiful, beautiful iPhone, smartphones, your smart cameras or your digital cameras. That's the right word, digital cameras. Then Kodak sat there and said, well, these guys are not going to survive. And why should I digitize? I am a market leader already. And what happened now? Does any of us remember Kodak and do any of us use those films?
Yeah, the funniest part is actually that Kodak had a digital camera.
Exactly.
You know, designed and they kept it basically, you know, hidden.
That's the problem with these people because they think after a certain point, they know better than the others, which is not bad, okay? But when you see the turn and twist and the tilt in the way the world is progressing around you and you keep holding on to your Kodak, that's not going to help you. And you're not going to help your residents too. Do you think there are going to be more residents to a doctor who is opposed to technology? Because we have heard it all. We have heard things like, I don't trust digital technology. I don't trust simulations. I only want to do cadavers. But how long can you sustain on a cadaver? And now with the CO2 emissions and problems coming up, cadavers are not going to stay that long. And if there is a resident who does something wrong, the cadaver is destroyed. So what happens to others who are patiently waiting? So how do you help them get better? So we are not interested in the Kodaks of the medical world. What we are interested in those that are open to accepting and those who know digital is the future. So when these Kodak guys know that they're not going to exist anymore, either they are going to join the bandwagon, which is going to be at a very later stage, or they are going to be left out, like what happened to Kodak. Mm. So that's the example I always give people when they ask. It's difficult. And if you go behind these people, they demoralize you. So it's better to stay away from the stage that we are in. This is also a learning we had. And focus your attention on those that are supportive of you and grow with them, which is the best strategy to have.
Plus, well, you're not also the, say, tech guys now, right? Because also you have a doctor on board.
Exactly.
So you have the Dr. Ralph Wagner who joined your team.
Yep.
What would be his role?
Oh, first of all, we are very, very, very fortunate to have such a huge surgeon. So just to give a brief outline or background on Dr. Wagner. So he is the best uniportal surgeon that you can find in the world. He has done until today 5,000 endoscopic surgeries. Most of the doctors in Germany learned from him. He is super, super, super talented. And we met him. He tried the system. And he said, you know what, this is going to change the training world in endoscopic spine. And
oh, wow.
There are a lot of people who are begging me. This is the exact words he used. They are begging me to help them train, but I don't have the time. So if I have a company like yours who can offset some of my time, put a system out there, and this AI proctor does everything, I can also see where they did the mistake. And when I take them to a cadaver lab, I can tell them exactly what not to do there, because I know. So this is revolution, and I want to be part of this. That he was very straightforward, which is what we loved about him. And his main goal, or his main job, or his main idea in joining Simulatory is he's going to be our chief medical officer. He's going to work with all of these other excellent KOLs. The best part was all our KOLs get along excellent with him. So which tells a lot about Dr. Wagner. Despite being such a huge personality, he is very down to earth, very straightforward, and he gets along with everybody really well, which is very difficult because after a certain age, you go. And with him on board, this is going to boost our status and the way Simulatory is perceived outside in the medical community, which is exactly what we need at this point, because we have a good product. We have a tech team. We have the perfect KOLs behind it. We needed a doctor backing it. Now we have Dr. Wagner. So what else can we ask? So this has been truly the pivotal point for us in having Dr. Wagner join us as a co-founder and as a chief medical officer.
What is success for Simulatory? Like how do you see like the big success?
Success for us. I mean, I am a greedy CEO. Okay. I love to expand and be successful. The success for us is I want every single resident, every single person who thinks of endoscopic training, think of VR Spine, think of Simulatory. We want to be synonymous with training and planning for endoscopic spine, because that's the future. And we want to lead these people into the future, like give them an opportunity to take that and run with it and get better, which is basically we also grow with them.
Right. I can see you are already in full speed. Like, what do you need to make it happen?
Money. Funding. As any company, we are looking for funding. And we do have some excellent investors already vested in us. Some of the best. We have people from all parts of the countries. I mean, Germany predominantly. So most of our investors are from Germany. We have a lead on board. He is the best I can ask for. Very supportive, very, very diligent lead. And all the investors that followed him I couldn't ask for more. And we are at the best stage that we can be with the right type of people coming in for us. So the next step for us is to close our 2.5 million round. So if you guys are interested, reach out to me.
Yeah. Now, I also know that you don't want to stop with ultra-minimally invasive spine endoscopic surgeries, right? What's the bigger plan, or what's the bigger future for Simulatory?
That's an excellent question. I take a very pragmatic approach. What I mean by that is one of my job as the CEO of the company is to have a proper laid out future pathway that is communicated effectively within all aspects of the teams. So I take a very pragmatic approach. We do a 5-year, 7-year plan. In those 5 years, I want Simulatory to be the global leader in synthetic patient data, number one. I will explain what that is. The second is, like I said, I want people to remember VR spine or think immediately of VR spine in the next 5 years when there is topic of endoscopic training. Now, the bigger picture that we have discussed, brainstormed, is complete the whole spectrum of the spine itself and then go to brain. And then we are also targeting robotic surgery, which is the future again. So we are not going to regress back into laparoscopy or arthroscopy, which is a very crowded place. There are people doing it. Let them do it. We want to stay one step ahead of the curve always. Always have the first mover advantage. And with the smart simulation platform, our next target is going to be robotics. Robotic surgeries, robot-assisted surgeries, exoscopes, which are coming up at very, very fast pace. Like, all the big companies have robot-assisted surgeries. You can search them, any of them, they have a robotic assistant. So that's the future. The next focus for us after that is going to be sports medicine, rehabilitation, prosthetics. Probably with haptics, we can go into sensation of bionic arms, but that's way, way, way out there.
Wow. So this sounds real, real huge.
Yeah, but that's way, way, way out there. But the two focus topics are going to be neurosurgery, which includes your brain and spine, followed by robotic surgeries.
Right. Gayatri, thank you very much for this seriously super interesting conversation. Like, we went deep into spine surgery, haptics, you know, robotics even in the end. So thank you very much for this. And for you guys listening, if you want to, you know, check at which stage Simulatory are now at, please go to the simulatory.com, which is thesimulatory.com. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
I'm totally impressed by the audacity of researchers turned startup founders, doctors turned entrepreneurs, or ordinary parents turned healthcare innovators. People battling the battles that no one fought before for the extra health of the future. So if you see a startup posting on LinkedIn, show them some love, hit like, comment, that's fabulous. If you have a couple drops more of that altruism, follow the Exhale Show, leave a review here. I'll be able to bring more of these visionaries to you. So a big thank you. You're awesome. See you next week.
The information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. If you have any medical questions, please consult your healthcare practitioner. The opinions on the show are Alex's or her guests. The podcast does not make any responsibility or warranties about guest statements or credibility. While the podcast makes every effort to ensure that the information shared is accurate, please let us know if you have any comments, suggestions, or corrections.